Greetings, and welcome to the Virtus First Quarter 2019 panel call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the one followed by the four on your telephone. If at any time during the call you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this call is being recorded Monday, April 22nd, 2019. I would now like to turn the call over to Barry Mandenack, Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandenack. Welcome to today's panel discussion. Today's call will be moderated by our Chief Market Strategist, Joe Terranova, and will feature key portfolio managers Dave Albright, George Gadelius, and Matt Benkendorf. Dave Albright is the Chief Investment Officer of Newfleet Asset Management. George Gadelius serves as Managing Director, Head of Leveraged Finance, and Senior Portfolio Manager at Sykes Investment Advisors. Matt Benkendorf is the Chief Investment Officer of Vontobel Asset Management. Gentlemen, welcome, and thank you all for joining us today. I'd like to now turn the call over to Joe Terranova, who will provide a brief overview of what took place in the markets during the first quarter and some thoughts about the second quarter before he begins with questions from our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry, and good afternoon. Welcome to all of you that have joined the call. Happy holidays, first and foremost, to you, and thank you for dialing in the day after a weekend of holiday. Anyway, time to get back to the markets, and certainly, as Barry mentioned, the first quarter was a very significant one for basically all asset classes. We saw a significant recovery, and I think investors were reminded in the importance of diversification, but diversification in terms of three strategies. Diversification not only in terms of an asset class, diversification in terms of geography, and diversification in terms of strategy. You have the opportunity here over the next hour for us to engage in a conversation about what occurred in the capital markets in Q1, but really, let's focus a little bit more on the outlook for Q2 from three gentlemen that offer diversification in geography, diversification in strategy. See, the marketplace in Q4, in my estimation, went through a correction, but it was a correction that was misinterpreted by investors and really was a momentum equity correction. It provided a rebalancing opportunity when you're thinking about the portfolio. I think we got a great reminder from interest rates moving back lower, 10-year, which was 3.25% in September, approaching down to 2.35% in March and back up to 2.60% right now. We got a little bit of a reminder that the other asset classes are incredibly important in that portfolio construction. We've got three gentlemen here to do that today. I mentioned rebalancing. Just quickly before I begin the dialogue with these three portfolio managers, let's remind everyone about rebalancing. Let's remind everyone over the last 12 months, real estate utilities have been the better performers. Let's think about Q3, and did you have your clients clamoring and having the phones and the emails coming in intensively looking for the opportunity when munis were pulling back? We want to also look at the year-to-date performance and remind ourselves of the economic troubles in Europe, specifically Western Europe, but yet S&P companies that have sales into Western Europe are up 24% year-to-date from a strategy, an S&P strategy standpoint. That's the second highest international sales, which were up 24 points. The market has a very interesting way of reminding investors about the behaviors that have been consistent towards the success in portfolios for multiple decades, and that's why we're here today. We're here to talk about the asset classes, the strategy, the geography that constructs a portfolio, not just specifically about talking about the momentum equities, the FAANG names, the hyper-growth stocks that seem to define the business headlines in Q4, and unfortunately, probably pointed the investors in the wrong direction. I'd like to begin the conversation, and if I could, I mentioned before interest rates, certainly 3.25% back in September, 2.35% in March, inverted yield curve when you're looking at the 3 month to the 10-year. It's slipped into negative territory. It runs now about 15 basis points. German 10-year yields, negative territory, back into positive territory now. But David Albright, there was a tremendous pivot on the part of the Federal Reserve at the beginning of 2019. It was followed up by a 60 Minutes interview by the Federal Reserve Chairman. Please share with the advisors on the call today, what would your outlook be in terms of Federal Reserve policy, and how would it impact the asset classes that on each given day you're managing?
Sure, Joe. You're exactly right. There was an about-face from Powell speaking back on October 2nd, where they indicated there would be a possibility of 4 rate increases, and then the Powell pivot or reverse occurred, where right now the market is looking at no rate increases for the remainder of this year. We're sort of on board with that. We see a decelerating economy in the U.S., moderating inflation. It really gives the Fed, I think, leeway not to have to raise rates or not to have to cut rates. You know, right now we're 50-50 on either, if either will occur later in the year. If we start to see a pickup in economic growth in the U.S., inflation begin to pick up, we would need a 10-year at 3% and 2s to 10s at about plus 30 for the Fed to cut for the Fed to actually raise rates. On the flip side, if we see a deteriorating economy, slower growth, there's also the possibility that you could see the Fed cut rates later in the year. As far as where rates are right now, I think in the inversion of the curve, I think that was technically driven, Joe. You had mentioned Germany having a negative rate. If you look at the 10-year yields currently, the U.S., we're right around 260. Japan has a negative 10-year at negative 4 basis points. Italy, with a massive banking problems, at 259. Spain, one level above junk at 106. And Portugal, one level above junk at 115. You still have $10.5 trillion of negative rates around the world, so very difficult for me to see rates in the U.S. moving up anytime quickly. But right now, we're sort of in agreement that the Fed is on hold. No reason for them to move either way, at least over the next 12 months.
So, Matthew, you heard David's comments. Sounds like it's an easy monetary policy once again. It impacts the asset classes that you manage on a daily basis. You consider yourself and certainly your performance and your style and your strategy dictates. You're certainly a high conviction manager. Being a high conviction manager in the environment that we endured in Q4, and then kind of seeing this pivot in Q1, just kind of share with us how you implement what the criteria surrounding your investment strategy when you see in such a short duration such a significant change in sentiment, in monetary policy, in investor behavior, and really in terms of fund flows.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, certainly the environment has been shifting a lot, as you describe it. I think the key is, to the punchline of your question, we stay the course. It's part and parcel of this quality approach we follow. You mentioned we're high conviction, we're benchmark agnostic. We own what we think are durable, more predictable businesses growing already at attractive rates of return. And part of how we define quality has to do with predictability and durability. So, what we saw with the shakeout in Q4, we stood the course. We didn't have to adjust tack, adjust the portfolios. Our portfolios fared well, the worse the environment got on a relative basis. But also, because these are great businesses and they are growing, when the pressure alleviates or the sentiment that you've talked about continues to gyrate around and shifts back positive, we participate in that lift off the bottom. And that comment or what you started the question on interest rates, that backdrop has certainly helped in the emerging markets, right, as well. You focused on the developed markets, but that backdrop took away one of the key pressure points squeezing emerging markets and emerging market currencies. So I think what we have now is a resumed environment of some more base level of stability. I think you've come off the bottom of the markets and emerging markets about 3 years ago now. So now it comes down to differentiation between companies and earnings growth. There's a few big structural overhangs still, right, these trade dispute and a few things here and there, but let's not forget the emerging markets aren't just China either, where everybody is very singularly focused right now, right? We have Taiwan, we have Vietnam, we have Poland and Eastern Europe, Malaysia, Indonesia, right? This isn't just a world of the U.S. and China, and in emerging markets, it's not just China. And across the board, if you look around, I think things are pretty good. And you take away now that backdrop of this continuous squeeze of interest rates, I think we've got a base level effect where we can sit back, pick and choose companies, and we'll be in good shape.
So, Matt, just real quick, in that environment, whether it's the emerging markets, whether it be some of the international markets, it seemed as though in 2018 and maybe a little bit of 2017, the high yield attraction of U.S. assets just kind of blinded investors towards any fundamental strength that was emanating from an emerging market enterprise or an international company. Do you think now there's more visibility, the optics are clearer, that you could look at the pure fundamentals of these companies now that investors aren't just blinded and fixated by where's the high yield capture? Oh, it's in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think, I'd split the world a couple different ways, right? Looking ex-U.S. as you're asking the question. I think Europe will be in its own bucket, number one. So the developed markets will have their own sort of relative challenges based on interest rates there. And economic overhangs, political overhangs with Brexit, et cetera. I put that in one bucket. But if I attack your question more in the emerging market sense, right, what you had with progressively increasing U.S. interest rates, pushing strength in U.S. dollars, you had this flight away from what was a carry trade initially in emerging markets, those higher yielding places like Indonesia, for example, right? So that was squeezing out of that country as people were, to your description, coming back to the U.S. where yields were going higher and it was perceivably safer, right, especially from U.S. dollar investors' perspective. Now that you had that stopped, right, I think that takes the pressure off. In the meantime, while that was going on, a lot of these countries continue to do prudent things. Indonesia handled itself prudently. India continued to handle itself prudently, even though its currency was under pressure. Rates were still going up at that point. Now I think the heart of your question, what you get to see happen are two things, right? One, a lot of these countries will be cutting rates now, right? So that was off the table in the previous environment. But given where they are now, I think well underpinned economically, they have the added glass half full yet to now some continue to cut rates. You start to see that in India, and you'll start to see that in some other markets as well because that U.S. dynamic has now changed. So that's a good news, right? That'll just continue to fuel and push forward their economic growth, broadly speaking, which is a good thing. I think the second half to your question, yeah, then with that in place now and some of this volatility reduced because of the squeeze out of those markets that was more asset allocation driven or chasing, it's a great environment now to differentiate with stock picking again, right? There's no clear discernible wave driving everything. So the backdrop being at least stable, it's a great world for a stock picker right now for sure.
Okay, so it seems as though so far much of this conversation is about rates, the impact of the rate environment on all asset classes, domestic, international, emerging markets. It sounds a little bit similar to the 2016 environment. I think the three of you gentlemen would agree with that. But George, clearly something happened in Q4 when you looked at the loan market that was very disconcerting to investors. And the question that I keep getting when I'm talking to the investment community is, well, the loan market, the leveraged loan market, is going to signal to us when this asset recovery has run its course and it's ready to pare back the gains that we've seen over the last 3 to 4 months. They've identified leveraged loans as that one area of the marketplace that's going to be that signal. Do you agree with that? If you don't agree with that, give us the evidence why that is not the case.
I don't agree, and there's a few reasons for that, Joe. So I would say that, you know, the loan market is very much a U.S.-centric asset class. It really is pinned to the economy, and that's always what's most important. It's not interest rates, it's not inflation, and it's not flows. The asset class has had, you know, periods of outflows. For example, you know, April 2014 through June 16, 2 years of continuous outflows. The market was up during that time frame. So the mutual fund universe in loans is a very small part of the overall market. There are separately managed accounts, there are CLOs, there's banks that hold paper. So ultimately, mutual funds are in the low teens as a percentage of the market. So what we saw in Q4 clearly was a very pronounced outflow period, a very compressed period of time during the holidays. And so you did have a pretty sharp sell-off. But, you know, in the 3.5 months since then, we've clawed back about 70% of that decline. And, you know, the important thing to note is that it was a liquidity-based sell-off, not fundamentals-based sell-off. So I would say since then that, you know, new issuance is more stable than it was last year. We're seeing less LBO activity. We're down 25% in new issuance, so that's leading to a technicals imbalance where you have, you know, investors looking at new issues, not, you know, really satisfied with how much of an allocation they're getting and they're buying in the secondary. So the market has moved from about a price of 95 to almost 98 now, but it's about 97.75. CLO demand, which was down double digits, is now up 1% on the year. And again, to your point earlier, yes, we will decelerate a little bit on GDP this year. But let's keep in mind where we've been the last 10 years. We've averaged just about 2%. And if we have, you know, 2 to 2.25% type growth this year, that will be a very strong backdrop for the loan market.
So you mentioned the CLO market. The demand is from where you're sitting, the demand is strong. Less deals, but strong demand still?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, you know, a lot of money has been raised. You know, there was a period of time where there was something called risk retention, you know, was something that was mandated as a result of the, you know, some of the regulatory changes back post-crisis. That has since been rolled back, but a lot of money was raised during kind of 15, 16 into 17, and that money, much like private equity capital that's raised, gets deployed over a period of time. So there's a backlog, if you will, and you know, so that is something that we expect to continue throughout the rest of this year, probably through the end of next year. In addition to just regular way CLOs that are being that are still being created, and so that supports the strong technical that we've been seeing for the, you know, the first quarter this year.
Okay, so strong demand coming back once again, Dave. I want to bring you back in again because George mentioned the liquidity concerns in December, and again, I want to spend much of this call. Listen, we all know what happened in Q4. We've seen the recovery in Q1. The question on everyone's mind on this call is it sustainable? Is the sustainability in all these asset classes that have recovered? I mentioned 2016 before. Does it look like 16, where you have a very strong recovery and it sustains itself throughout the year and rolls into the following year, which was 2017? High yield market in Q4, I don't think you saw one deal get done, Dave. You're seeing deals get done again in Q1, much better environment. I saw today a statistic. You're seeing that investment banks, JP Morgan, suggesting a return to the mortgage market once again. We're seeing strong flows into high yield munis once again. The flows are absolutely there. Is it sustainable, and what's driving that demand, which was in December, basically vanished?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what George said. It was, you know, more of a liquidity-driven crisis at the end of last year, whether, you know, it was mutual fund redemptions, which we saw in a variety of asset classes, high yield. We saw $20 billion in the fourth quarter. Loans, you know, $10 billion in the month of December. Emerging markets debt, huge reversal, about $17 billion in the last quarter. Investment-grade corporates also saw a reversal of flows. You know, the one thing now is we have come back pretty quickly. We've seen the high-yield market is up almost 8.5% this year. You know, EM debt, which was down through November of last year, about 7%, is up almost 6.5% out of the gate this year. And investment-grade corporates, which had a negative total return coming into last year, now is up almost 5%. So you've seen a huge retracement. Valuations are getting a little full. We're seeing in the high yield market spreads and dollar price approach the 1 and 5 year tights. In emerging markets, we're starting to see a nice retracement there. Now we're seeing the high yielders starting to catch a bid. The investment grade countries did very well. A lot of that was the move in duration with big move in rates. Now people are looking for the high yielders, so we're starting to take a look at those, and those specifically were last year's worst performers, countries such as Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, Russia, to mention a few. We've actually had an overweight in Mexico, which has retraced nicely last month. It was up over 3%. So we've seen a nice retracement come back, but valuations are full, so Joe, I think it comes down to looking forward. It's more relative value within sector. We're not selling risk assets. You know, we still think that even with economic growth, if it's somewhere from 1.5% to 2.5% in that range, that's good for credit. Defaults still remain very low.
David, let me stop you for a second. But why can't I get excited on a sector basis? I heard so much a couple of years ago about the concerns about energy and energy pricing and the impact on high yield. We come in this morning, we have energy prices at a six-month high, energy equities correlating with it. We have a consumer that has remained incredibly resilient even as the economy's contracted. So on a sector basis, can I still get excited about opportunity, whether it be in high yield or investment grade? And where would those sectors be that you get excited about?
Yeah, I mean, we do like the non-cyclicals. A lot of people were worried coming into this, coming at the end of last year, coming this year, that the triple B segment, was growing exponentially. It's now twice the size of the high yield market. People worried about, if you start to see a weakness in the market, you start to see downgrades. What happens when you have investment grade triple Bs that are now $2.5 trillion start to melt down into the high yield market, which is $1.2 trillion? We thought that was a great opportunity. Triple Bs were very, very, very cheap. We went out and we bought the sector that was 2008's best performing sector, the non-cyclicals, specifically food and beverage, pharma, and healthcare. A lot of those deals have done very, very well. We've sold a lot for profit. We sold Anthem recently. A lot of the mega deals that came were specifically in those categories, deals like Pfizer, Anheuser-Busch, Shire, Nestle, Cigna, CVS, to mention a few. So for us, we like the consumer non-cyclicals in the investment grade market. We still think those have value. However, it's going to be looking at value within sector. We're trying to take some chips off the table so we have some powder dry if there is some type of a correction. The high yield market, there we are focusing on gaming, pharma, energy, building materials, chemicals. Some of the energy names that we had in the portfolio, which when Paul spoke, when WTI was at $77 a barrel, by the end of December, it got all the way down. It's down about 37%, got below 50, which is sort of Moody's comfort zone, the 50 to 70 range. Right now, with the strength in oil, as you'd mentioned, we're taking that as an opportunity to sell some of the E&P companies and then swap into refiners and pipelines as a place to sort of sit, clip coupon, and if the market does correct or we see some type of volatility, we can buy some of the more high beta assets back.
So, Matt, you're hearing Dave talk about specific sectors, and clearly when we go outside the U.S., the economic environment is being categorized as one is clearly significantly challenged. I spoke to David about the U.S. consumer. Speak to me a little bit about the consumer, whether it's in India or some of the select emerging markets, because what I'm witnessing is significant downgrades in the earnings expectations. We saw that certainly in the month of January. In the U.S., we're now experiencing the reality of those earnings expectations being lowered, but earnings results are not as bad as feared. How should we be thinking about earnings in the consumer in the emerging markets? And with those expectations, have you or can you offer any insight to the portfolio construction, once again, that you're kind of changing the criteria or looking at things based on those lowered expectations?
Yeah, I think to keep it a little bit targeted for the listeners out there, I'll break out three buckets, to answer your question in terms of consumer. I think, like a lot of other places, it's not shocking. You see a bit of a bifurcated consumer, right? One area that's continue to boom, both developed market listed companies and emerging markets companies exposed to space is clearly luxury, right? And luxury in China. So even though China's gone through this economic slowdown and a recovery there domestically, luxury's been booming still, right, at the high end. One of the better performing spaces in China in the first quarter as well was the the Baijiu space, right, which is consumed liquor on happy sort of occasions. There's trading up, premiumization. That was booming in the first quarter again. Right, so you get some very much strength at the high end in places like China. I'd say sort of middle, lower income strata, I wouldn't say you're seeing a whole lot. In places like India, I think there you've seen strength in the consumer for some time actually now, so that's nothing new. You look at the results in consumer-oriented companies there, even the Western one once again, or the domestic ones. You know, you've seen strong growth in the consumer there for quite some time, and it's been reaccelerating, and that's actually what's pushing and helping push along some of the multinational companies like the Unilevers and Nestle's, right? That strong resurgence of emerging markets growth, and they have some big exposures to places like India, Unilever in particular. Then another big bucket is obviously Brazil. There, it's a slightly different story in that you're coming out of basically a depression a couple of years ago, a very deep recession. There, the consumer sentiment is improving. You're getting that feedback both from companies and managements and on the ground there. There's a steady improvement coming, albeit from a very deep pit, but it's progressive. And a lot of it's based there yet on optimism, political optimism for more liberalization, political optimism, you know, for some reform in the government. But that's good. That's sort of the beginning of some animal spirits there, which is positive. So, you know, long story short, to your question, just on three major buckets, you're seeing bifurcated action. And I think that goes back towards where you need to be laser focused, right? In China, once again, right, you've seen tremendous weakness in places like automobiles, but you have strength, as I mentioned, in places like Baijiu or in luxury goods. In India, in major consumer products that touch a broad swath of the population, strength. And in Brazil, as I said, you're at the beginnings of some recovery, and even places like beer, where there had been trading down, now that stopped, and you'll get trading back up again. But, you know, generally what's important about emerging markets is the road is long yet, right? So you'll get quarter-to-quarter cyclicality, of course. You'll get some prolonged periods of sort of mini-cycles within the super cycle here, but the key is there's still a very, very long runway in emerging markets because the consumption rates are just so low yet.
Gotcha. All right, George, stay with me one second because Matt just mentioned a little bit about India, and I just want to talk the market today, the equity market in India. I think Matt, if I'm correct, it was down the most it's been down in the last, or certainly year to date, but that really was on the jump in pricing of oil. Obviously, India, a significant importer. So let's kind of tackle two challenges as it relates to India. A higher oil price is a significant importer, and then we have the election coming up in the spring. Just quickly walk us through those potential headwinds.
Yeah, no, you nailed it, Joe. Look, India, you're right. That's the biggest squeeze point for that economy, typically energy. Typically, it's a spike. You know, they can weather, like most economies, a prolonged either increase or decline. It's just the spikes. The secondary effect of that, which you have to look out for, is clearly any political reaction. Right, India, you know, has very sound finances, I'd call it, a very independent central bank. It does run manageable but twin deficits. It's got a very liberalized democracy. It's got a lot of great things going for it, but oil is the one pressure point. Now, the flip side of that coin, there's always two sides to a coin, is India, though, is also a fairly insular economy outside of the oil price pressures, right? It's a very dynamic, diversified economic base, you know, across all strata of different industries and sectors. So that's the good news there. But, you know, the oil price will put a little bit of near-term pressure on, and then you hope that there's not a political response to some sort of favor-giving, which sort of dives into the second part of your question. I'd say the oil price we're not as concerned with here, certainly not at these levels even after the recent increase. You'd have to get to much higher levels before it become a bigger issue. But the politics are going to be the noise near-term. It's kind of ebbed and flowed a little bit. There was a little bit more concern about a month ago that the rival Congress party is picking up a little more ground versus the incumbent BJP party. Then the BJP started to pull away again, and now in recent days, obviously, you get this flurry again as the elections get a little bit closer, that maybe the challenger is gaining ground. I think the punchline, though, for politics, it's going to be noise, as you point out, rightfully so. When there's a world of asset allocators like to hop along lily pads here and there short term to try to make a quick buck, that'll certainly happen. But India has got great structural strengths and great businesses there to stay the long-term course. There'll be noise in the political process, but let's be frank, there's not a huge difference between the two major parties fighting here. The Congress party has several decades of great growth under their belt. The BJP party has brought in certainly some positive reforms, although disruptive in the near term, that are starting to bear fruit. Regardless of the outcome, there shouldn't be a major shift either way. But, you know, we've talked about, I think, in previous calls, politics does create some noise and some trepidation. It's going to start to creep into this country, as we see already, certainly in areas like healthcare, right? But we'll get through that in the next month by the end of May in India. And then actually the calendar for emerging markets looks good after that. So that's the good news. You've been through Indonesia. You've been through Thailand. The announced will be results will be announced yet soon. India is the last major one. And I think the good news then for emerging markets is there won't be a lot of political headwind for a while.
Excellent. I like focusing on good news. Speaking of good news, George, coming back to you once again, I just want to talk about, again, I think historically investors from a behavioral standpoint have looked at the leveraged loan market kind of incorrectly, and it's been more, I think they make the mistake of it's, okay, we've got a call on rates. We have rate expectation. Talk to me a little bit about volatility, because we've now seen a compression in volatility back to levels that we thought were unthinkable in December or January. We never thought we were going to see volatility come back down. And yes, you could say that's largely attributable to what's going on with the Federal Reserve. But how do I think about leveraged loans as a volatility hedge?
Ultimately, the leveraged loan asset class exhibits much lower vol than equities and high yield bonds, haven't checked it against EM. Obviously that it had a huge spike of volatility in 08, but I think if you look at it, for the 10 years since, during the sovereign debt crisis in 11, the energy sell-off late 15 into early 16, you see the difference of how loans hold up versus other asset classes. Last year, arguably one of the best asset class performances, positive returns, albeit modest. It's not free of volatility, but it's very low relative to its brethren. So ultimately, I think you have to look at the asset class as one that, compared to other risk assets, will typically sell off less. You will not have an up 30% year. It's not small cap equities. We accept it for what it is. A typical year is going to be mid-single digit type returns, but it should not be an asset class that you rent either. You could have sold in the middle of December, arguably at the worst time, and then sat out and watched, and depending where you put the money, let's just, for argument's sake, say you went in cash, we're up 5.25% this year, you would have missed it. So you could miss, 2-3 weeks, the 2-3 strong weeks out of the year, and then miss the bulk of the year's return. So I think it belongs as a permanent asset class, again, albeit a modest one, but one that, it's tough to time, but it produces, pretty consistent returns over long periods.
Okay, I got David and I got to Matt touch on earnings real quick. Could I ask you to do the same? Just how's the quality of earnings that we're seeing in the market?
Yeah, loan guys take a little bit longer than the S&P 500 folks to report. So that, we just saw kind of the last of
Q4
earnings.
Yeah.
Yes, the filtered in at really by the end of March. And, with some exceptions, of course, sectors like retail and energy, which happen to be the two best performing sectors this year, but, there are still some, weak links in those sectors. But I would say overall earnings have been solid. That is, as bottom-up managers, that is what we focus on. That is the key metric. We're not top-down managers looking at macro. We're looking at, the underlying quality of earnings, free cash flow generation, because that supports our asset coverage, and that supports, obviously, trading levels. So, what we saw in Q4 was very consistent, really, throughout the majority of 2018. And one bright spot of, interest rates being stable here is that interest coverage measures, which, some people were starting to worry about, for the lower segment of leveraged loans, is less of a concern now. So interest coverage levels at this point have basically eclipsed, the highs of about 18 years ago in the early 2000s when interest coverage was, at its previous high. So we've got leverage continuing to decline. Post-crisis leverage peaked in Q1 of 2016, not surprisingly, when the energy sell-off caused some of these metrics to, pull the averages higher. And since then, we've gone down, essentially continuously to the low fours on leverage for the market. So ultimately, this is very supportive of the asset class. Where it reminds me a little bit of the end of 15 into early 16, and 2015 was a very slightly negative year for loans, followed by a year that produced almost 10%, which is not what I'm suggesting for this year. Obviously, you can't just extrapolate what's happened the first 3.5 months, but with the returns that we've clipped year to date, I think it's certainly supportive of mid to high single digit type returns for this year.
Okay, great, Dave. I'm going to give you the last question here. While I do that, I'm just going to ask all those on the call to kind of begin to formulate some questions. We certainly want to take those. It's usually the most colorful and enjoyable part of this call. So please kind of think about that. We'll come to you here in a minute or so. But, David, I just want you to talk real quickly. Emerging market bonds, we're seeing some outflows. I think it's three consecutive weeks, and I think last week was probably the biggest outflow from the sector in the last 6 months. A lot of that is on the headlines. You're getting a little noise from Argentina, Turkey, and Brazil. Walk us through, please, how we should be thinking about EM debt.
Yeah, I mean, we look at LEVs in a basket. We'd include, leverage loans, high yield, and emerging markets. Based on, what George just said, being relative value investors, if I have a dollar in LEV fin, we like loans a lot more than high yield with the huge move that we've seen in the high yield market. When we throw emerging markets in there, emerging markets starting to look attractive, but you're right, Joe, you had, $24 billion of inflows and then 3 weeks of outflows. You've had big moves in countries. RG's still, I think, a volatile situation, weakening profile. We don't own any Argentina. We've sold most of our Argentina. We've also sold Turkey, which has been another problem. Brazil, we still have some corporate exposure. Russia, we still have some corporate exposure. And we also have recently added to Mexico and Indonesia. But we're using it strategically and tactically, a way to diversify away from, both high yield and loans. But I would say that if we had to overweight one right now, it would be leveraged loans versus high yield, supplementing that with some of the corporate exposure that we have in the high yielding EM space.
Great. Okay, Ash, if you wouldn't mind just kind of walking through the process to take some questions, I'll turn it over to you now.
Certainly. If you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. One moment, please, for the first question. And once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may press 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. And there appear to be no questions queued up over the phone lines at this time.
Ash, there's always a question. Once you get the first one, that's when the next two or three come in. So while we wait for that second or third question, I just want to just see if Barry... Barry, I believe you're still on the line. Did you want to take that first question?
From my perspective, I'll ask Matt Benkendorf, the thoughts about emerging markets. The home bias in the U.S. has been noted something in the order of 80%, and there's been a lot written about Cape-Shiller ratios, and while not a market timing tool, is valuable in terms of thinking about longer-term return potential. Where do you see emerging market equities from a valuation perspective and non-U.S. developed equities relative to U.S. as a manager of a global portfolio?
Yeah, I think, look, I'd go back to one punchline, an old punchline in my, in my, uh, start the answer with again that I think the emerging markets are getting more developed and the developed markets are getting a bit more emerging. Unfortunately for us, living in a developed market, that transition's a little bit more painful, right? The politics are getting a little bit more stable, a little bit more consistently pro-Western liberalized economic thought a bit, right? These countries have all been through hard times and have learned and have seen the light. And I'm speaking generally, but, you know, they're moving in the right direction, right? So the backdrop's good. The populations, depending on where you are, particularly like India, are very young. They're robust, and they're just consuming, once again, at fractions of what they should be and will be consuming at as per capita incomes grow and things get better and prosperity is good. So I think the runway of emerging markets getting more developed, i.e. using that in the positive, as a positive adjective, are very strong, right? And the good news, too, with emerging markets as well or in an emerging markets portfolio, while emerging markets itself has historically swung around as a class, I think you have a lot of potential going forward for a lot of buffeting of that volatility as well because you get a lot more diversity across emerging markets, too, now. You know, in the developed markets, I think things are getting a little bit more correlated in the equity world, at least. You know, a lot of the main drivers of the U.S. equities or what's going on in Europe can become very correlated now, given a lot of the dynamics going on. In emerging markets, still, you have a lot of diversified and different things going on across these very diverse and different economies, albeit with a lot of commonality in the positive pushes. Moving them forward. So, you know, emerging markets going forward, it's like a broken record. You know, that is the opportunity. It's not a very complicated story. The countries are run better now than they ever were and moving continually in the right direction. The businesses are run better than they have ever have been. But look, it's still life. Life is fraught with risk. It's still economies that are unpredictable. Through an economic cycle. So still, we believe we've got a good mousetrap for that. You know, we focus on quality and predictability. And we think with that, it's why I sort of speak with a lot of general comfort always about this. You know, we can sleep well at night. We know that crises or down cycles could come. But in the emerging markets in particular, for the long-term compounding potential, it's very, very attractive.
Okay, great. Thank you, Matt.
Ash, while we wait for that question to come in for the advisor, just quickly, I mentioned before, David, the performance of munis in Q3 and what a tremendous rebalancing opportunity that was. I obviously mentioned to the three of you when I began this call, I really wanted to reflect on Q1, but more importantly, look forward Q2. The outlook for munis, I think they're up about 2.5% year-to-date. Certainly that rebalancing opportunity in Q3, David, was a good one. How do you see the outlook here moving forward?
Yeah, investment grade are up about 260, Joe, and then the high-yield muni market's up about 3.5. Record inflows. We've had the best inflows recorded in the muni market going all the way back to 1992 when they started recording flows. Year-to-date, you've had about $27 billion of inflows. This last week alone, $3.8 billion of inflows. People probably figured out that you're not getting your state tax deductions in the, you know, some of the SALT states. So record inflows, you have pre-refundings that are no longer allowed, so that's about 20% of issuance is gone. So you have very, very positive technical backdrop. You know, you throw on top of that very positive tax collection, and then we still have a few question marks. What happens with Puerto Rico, the resolution there? They've already determined in Puerto Rico that anything issued after 2012 in the GO form is unconstitutional. We'll have to wait and see. If you look at the gap between bonds issued pre-2012 and post-2012, it's about a 20-point gap. Throw on top of that, you know, the ultimate resolution, what goes on there, you have $70 billion of defaulted GO debt. You have $30 billion of unfunded pension liability with another $20 billion to rebuild the island. $120 billion of total liabilities on a country, on an island that has the economic power of Mississippi. They've lost about half their population. They're about 2.8 million down from 6 million just 10 years ago, while government employees have tripled. So that's a question mark. How that's ultimately resolved is a big question. Throw on top of that, you have the city of Chicago, which is in worse shape than Detroit. Illinois is in much worse shape as a parent, versus Michigan. Right now, their debt is rated double B by both. $37 billion of unfunded pension liability in the city of Chicago. The governor just vetoed an additional $7 billion of issuance due to the fact that they have to get their house in order. And then lastly, the unfunded pension liability space show, one that we live in Connecticut. You have New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Illinois. You're seeing what everybody should have anticipated is, for example, David Tepper decided to leave New Jersey. That was $332 million of state income tax for the state. He moved down to Florida. The top 2% pay 70% of state income tax, and they're all looking to move to Texas, Tennessee, California, Washington, South Dakota, Nevada, New Hampshire. What's going to happen to the entitlements 4 to 5 years down the road when everybody bolts? So something you have to watch very closely. I would just say from a valuation perspective, investment grade looks attractive, 10 to 30 year. 0 to 10 year looks very, very rich. And then I would also say on the high yield side, you've had a big run. Looks like we're at right now the tightest levels we've seen going all the way back to 09. So high yield munis have had their run. Puerto Rico has recovered from a pricing standpoint. You've seen a big move in tobacco bonds. They're trading at 9-year tights. Port and port authorities are also at 9-year tights. So you're going to continue to see demand there, especially from the states, the salt states. But we like munis on a total return basis, but we'll stay in the 10 to 30-year part of the curve when we buy those as a crossover trade.
Great. Thank you, David. Ash, can we open it up and see if we've got any questions?
Certainly. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may press 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. One moment, please, for the next question. And there appear to be no questions queued up over the phone lines at this time.
Okay. Well, for myself personally, I want to thank everyone for joining this call today, and I will turn it over to Barry Mandadak. Thank you. Barry?
Okay. Thank you, Joe, and thanks, Dave, George, and Matt, for your time as well, and thank you all for dialing in. Really, really appreciate it. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit our website at virtus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Once again, Joe, Dave, George, Matt, thank you all for your time today. Appreciate it, and everybody have a great evening.
That does conclude the call for today. We thank you all for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.